Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we talk to foresters about how they are using digital technologies in their day-to-day forestry work. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Rod Poirier. He's the owner of JRP Solutions. Rod, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to see you. We saw each other a little while ago at the Ko-fi event in Vancouver, and then we were chatting with the podcast, and I remember I kind of grabbed you and Julie and said, hey, one of you have to get on the pod, and you were like, really, should we? And here we are, so thanks so much for signing up. I'm not sure, I know we chatted, and you're like, oh, I listen to the podcast when I'm gardening, and I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I've heard that one before. Normally I listen to it before I go to bed because you knock me out. I'm like, perfect, mission accomplished. But gardening, hey, that's definitely interesting. So where am I reaching you today?
I'm in Courtney and on Vancouver Island in BC.
Nice. Gorgeous geography. And has that been home base for you for forever?
No, been about 20 years, I guess we've been here. So for me, though, I am from Vancouver Island. Born and raised in Port Alberni. So that was not too far from home, about an hour away, I guess, right now, in terms of where I've spent most of my life here is on Vancouver Island. So yeah, not too far. But Courtney, we've been here, we moved our business here from the northern part of Vancouver Island. We moved it down about 20 years ago. So.
Okay. Well, I like how it's like, oh, it's just 20 years ago and still a substantial time there. So born and raised Vancouver Island, forestry connection. Tell me about that journey.
Pretty natural connection. Port Alberni is, as you know, a lot of people I guess won't know, but Port Alberni is definitely a timber town. Certainly was when I was growing up in the 70s. It was we had 5 sawmills and a pulp mill and a paper mill and and lots of loggers. My father was a logger for 38 years or something like that. Grew up in the rural side of the town, so always in the forest. Whether I still live on a rural property in the forest, so pretty honest connection to forestry my whole life. When I eventually finished high school and went to university, I chose forestry as a career path. And went through the program at UBC for forest resource management. So
okay, yeah. So you did leave the island at least for a while. You headed over to mainland, went to University of British Columbia, had a little stint there. Probably thought, oh God, why am I here in concrete jungle when I can be back in beautiful Vancouver Island? Or was there a romance component? Or tell me, was there ever a I'm leaving the island and going east or maybe further west, depending the view of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're pretty blessed here on the west coast of North America, the Pacific Northwest, as I guess we refer to it most of the time, between Washington, Oregon, BC, and even up to Alaska. Beautiful place to live. So I think I have traveled a bit, and it's funny, and you come home and you realize as amazing as lots of areas are in the world, this is definitely a pretty special place. So I never really had a desire to leave. So my wife and I both went through forestry together, and both had normal forestry careers for a while before branching into sort of the digital side. But right after school we did go up north for a couple of years and spent some time up in the northern part of the province, and so experienced a few sort of northern winters, but eventually jobs available on where we wanted to live, which was on the island, and so we moved back.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, this summer our family is going to have a little vacation on Vancouver Island. I've been a few times. And for those listeners or viewers who have never been, I highly recommend you check out Vancouver Island. It's just amazing from the south end. Maybe I've only gone halfway up because I know there's a whole other part there, but gorgeous geography there. So as we think about forestry, you mentioned you went to school. And so maybe tell me about some of the jobs that you may have had before you launched JRP Solutions. And what were those experiences like as a freshly or recently graduated UBC forestry grad?
Right. So, essentially went through the forestry program at UBC, which was, it's fairly generic. It's a forest resource management program, which at the time, I think there's a little bit more specialties nowadays. If you go through, you can sort of specialize a little bit more. Back then, there was the primary program, which for most people were in. There was a sort of a harvest engineering program as well. But went through the resource management side and, kind of ended up, you sort of just go into whatever, you're sort of a generalist at that point. So, when I started, my sort of working career, I mean, I was doing summer student stuff as well, but, I started off doing a combination of civil culture. So, when we first went up north in the summertime, you're doing, chasing tree planters, that kind of thing. So doing, civil culture, supervising civil culture projects, and then working with different crews doing those projects, and sort of learning a lot about project management and organizing, and it's fairly intense. That side's a very interesting part of forestry. I think almost everywhere you go, not just BC, a lot of chaos, a lot of people all at once, and a lot of things happening all at once. Trees need to get in the ground in a certain window. You can't just sort of plant them all year long at a steady pace. You just sort of blast it off right when in between freezing and growing season. And quite busy with that, learned a bit there, then transitioned to didn't really transition, but the in the wintertime, it's mostly engineering work that's available. So they call that engineering, but realistically what you're doing is painting boundaries. So you're walking around in snowshoes or whatever, spray painting trees to mark the boundaries of the harvest areas and that kind of thing. So, fairly basic junior jobs in the forest industry. And did that for a while. When we moved down back to Vancouver Island, similar kinds of positions were, doing a lot of sort of forest harvest engineering, locating roads, harvest boundaries, that kind of thing. Again, instead of painting, typically on the coast we hang ribbons instead of paint. I changed jobs at some point and focused on silviculture for a few years, which again was sort of, that was an all year round, full-time silviculture forester job where you're basically looking after, on the coast, we have a little bit more variety of silviculture activities where we're maybe doing some spacing or some pruning of trees and also tree planting and site prep and those kinds of things. So,
right.
Did that for a few years and then slowly kind of transitioned into the contractor private contractor consulting, I guess is generally referred to as part of the business. So we did that. I guess if we go back just to kind of frame it properly, my wife and I were both in the industry, and my wife ended up in a contract position implementing software systems. So back then there were fairly basic software systems, but they were being rolled out to the forest industry. So a lot of the forest companies, and this is back in the early 90s, late 80s, so I guess early 90s. So in the early 90s, there was a lot of the forest industry was just moving to sort of electronic record keeping, and you just putting in place some planning systems and some stuff that gave them a little bit more organizational sort of computerized approach. But the industry was lagging behind other industries, of course, and by that point, banking and stuff, everybody was using ATMs and, everything was electronic and forestry was kind of being dragged along into that world. And being sort of younger and in the forest industry at the time, that was often put upon the older foresters are like, you guys go figure out that computer thing. So we did, and my wife ended up in a sort of contracting position, helping implement one of these solutions. And she worked at that with a few different companies and ended up with a number of clients after a few years. And then we started a family. So at that point, I had to choose whether, she had a business going with, I'm not sure if it was 8 or 9 employees. And I was working full time for one of the companies, local forest company as a silviculture forester. And I had to choose whether I was going to, just stay on that path that I was on as a silviculture forester with that company, and or go and help the business starting a family. Our first child was born in 96. And so it was like, well, I think I need to go and help run the business so that my wife can have more time with the kids. So it became sort of a life work balance issue. And I left my job and went to work on the contracting side, and consulting. You're running around with when I joined the business, I was doing some of the field work stuff that I was doing for companies, but I was doing that as a consultant or whatever, and still trying to run the office, that kind of thing, still implementing systems. And then we transitioned again. Sort of the next big wave in the mid 90s was GIS. Implementing and for back then it was data capture. There was no line work, there was no data. The government had big programs. Some of the forest companies, some of the larger forest companies that could afford it, were spending lots of money on getting some of their data, their geographic data digitized and organized and connected to some of the other historical record keeping. And as being in that side of things, there's a lot of work to be done to get to a certain point where you can actually start to use the tools, because you need to. So that was we got into that. We helped a lot with developing some of that line work, and got into sort of the GIS consulting side of things, as well as field consulting. We were doing field work, GIS. So we were sort of at that point more of an all-rounded forestry consulting outfit, and doing some GIS work, some field work, some implementing work, just sort of a whole basket of typical stuff back then. My wife, she was still active in the business, so took some time off with our first one when she was little, and then when she could, she joined back into the business. And so we worked at that for a number of years until we relocated. So just before we relocated, we refocused about 2002, refocused the business on software only. So during that time, we started working on the projects that today were entirely focused on, which is our software application offerings that we have for ourselves. And so we started developing those in 97. I didn't really have a product until about 99. It was sort of a little bit of a slow cooker, kind of doing it on the side of our desk. Around 99, we started having a product and working on that as well as everything else. By about 2002, we actually took on some partners, and restructuring. Then we dropped the rest of the businesses that we're doing, the rest of the sort of business activities that we were involved in, to focus 100% on the software side of the business. And so there was a lot of change for us business-wise back in the early 2000s, sort of 2003. And by 2003, we moved down to where we are now, which is sort of the central, some people call it Northern Vancouver Island, but it's really just sort of the center of Vancouver Island, just as easier access for travel. So at that point, I was traveling a lot trying to sell software. So I was your typical traveling forestry software salesman. So
long drives, lots of flights. Mostly driving, exactly. Unless you had the corporate jet, right? But just joking, of course. We're all laughing. We know that doesn't exist. Yeah. But just thinking of maybe two questions there to jump in there, and thinking of the decision to focus on the products and that transition period. Had you built a product before, or is this kind of like something completely new, or was there some previous experience where it's like, oh, I feel pretty confident that this is the path forward? But what was that trigger that signaled to you all that, now is the right time to maybe pivot the business, if that's the right word, and maybe let go some of the things that were not critical for the long-term vision that you had?
We were so at that up to that sort of critical juncture, we were, we bootstrapped the project entirely. It's we'd spent, gobs of money on it, all the money we could afford to spend on it and then some, without really any returns. So it was bootstrapping it is slow, and it's just, you sort of go as you can do it. Well, we didn't, have any big loans or any access to some serious capital that could sort of get you off the runway quicker. So we were stuck kind of going at the speed we were going, and it was fine. The catalyst to do that was actually bringing on partners. So we brought on two different partners, one sort of a private individual, another forester, and the other partner right afterwards. It didn't happen all at the same time. It happened all within about 6 months, though. We brought on one partner, and then we brought on later that year, we brought on another partner, which was a publicly held company, a big organization that bought into our business. That provided the capital, and the so essentially them buying into the business is an injection of capital. It allows you to go for it essentially. Now you can focus on that. Don't worry about making money on the other things. Just go and sell as hard as you can and see if you can get sort of the company off the runway, or the product kind of going where you can be somewhat profitable. So that was good fortune for us, and a great stepping stone. It allowed us to get ahead of the game a lot quicker. So those were good times, bringing on some partners, having some injection of capital, a lot of excitement, just pedal to the metal, trying to we're also developing product at the same time, trying to sell product. That was essentially our good fortune. It's different in some situations where maybe somebody gets hired to build a product that they can then go sell to other people. We didn't really have that. But we got the other version of it where, people buy into your business and you end up with some capital that you can use to get yourself going. So that was our good fortune business-wise in terms of being able to get off the ground.
Nice.
So for a few years, and that was kind of one of the reasons we relocated, was to make it easier to sort of do that full-time selling kind of aspect. And back then, selling over, like nowadays, we don't have to travel as much. As we all know, web meetings and that are kind of king, just because of the convenience factor. You don't have to, be in town at the time that the other person has a time available. You can sort of schedule things. And we still travel a little bit, but compared to back then, where it was really face to face, was a lot of the
Absolutely.
meetings and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, it was put a lot of miles on trying to get familiar with different, and you also had to I had to learn a lot about, how, you sort of know how things are done in your area, but as you travel out, and you sort of learn, okay, what do you have to do to the software to make it work better in these other regions or in these circumstances. So that
Absolutely.
was very, very
Absolutely.
good. Yeah.
Yep. Well, it's the life of the entrepreneur, right? You gotta sometimes do those things that are non-scalable and be on the road and listen to your customers. So with that, why don't we jump into JRP Solutions? Last check on the website, there's three products, Forest Ops, Snap, and help me on the third one,
Yeah, Plant Wizard.
Plant Wizard, there we go. So why don't you, which one's the most well-known one? And why don't you introduce us to that one first and what some of its capabilities are?
Sure. I'll give you the just to keep this from being any kind of a sales pitch,
Oh,
but
pitch
I'll
away,
keep
pitch
it. I'll,
away.
I'll
Don't
keep,
be
no, no, no,
shy.
no. It's boring. I don't want to bore your audience. So, but just to give kind of an overview on all three. So our first product was the Plant Wizard product, and it still carries that name. It's kind of half rebranded at the moment into SSMS, which not SQL Server Management System, but
that's what I was thinking. That's what I was thinking.
But we had an online component to PlantWizard that we started really early, like 2002, 2003. We started with an online web app for coordinating seedlings. So that's been going on for over 20 years. It was our sort of our second app, but it was a connection to PlantWizard. So at one point we called it PlantWizard Online, and then we moved it to SSMS. But now all of our features are basically moving to that, or have moved to that web app. So the desktop app is what's branded. We have a desktop and a mobile app. The desktop app is and the mobile app are still branded as PlantWizard. And that's just more for continuity at this point, but eventually one day I think that branding or that name will fade. So just it's kind of a little bit of a confusing mix of product names, but it's all one product. It's we still refer to it as PlantWizard internally, the entire thing. And it currently has sort of three components: a desktop application, a mobile application that's designed to work on phones and tablets, iOS or Android, and then a web app version, which is just gives, you know, it's basically the same features as the desktop version with just the accessibility bonus of being able to use it in a web browser from anywhere on any device kind of thing. So like I say, the desktop app is fading for us because it's harder to support. It's it's not as convenient for the user base, as everyone knows, a web app, you bypass all of that sort of headaches of internal infrastructure, installations, maintenance of that application, where we can just sort of have it hosted and manage it that way. So that was so that product was our first product. So we started off, and the progression for that really was a desktop. And then we built a Palm Pilot version that would connect and sync with the desktop. And
Palm Pilot. Lord, yeah. I have not heard Palm Pilot said in so many decades. I was going to say years, but literally decades. But wow, Palm Pilot. Okay, we're dating ourselves here.
I'm not as young as I look, but we did a lot of work with Palm OS. It was we were like in the earliest of Palm Pilots. We were we built a number of versions of apps for the Palm OS over the new version every year kind of thing, and it was very popular because they were cheap. They're really cheap little devices. Their battery lasted a long time. A lot of them, you just had batteries. You put AAA batteries in them, and away you go. Black and white screens, you probably remember, very basic device, still, from a tech point of view, very admirable. Me personally, I think they were great. They were quick, they were easy, they were cheap. They didn't lag if you use them. As we build up these more fancy smartphones and operating systems, they do more, but everything costs you more. The applications don't run any faster. There's no, sure it's color and that kind of thing. But no, they were great. They worked really well. But that was our first sort of foray into the mobile environment. And being in forestry, it was like, you build a desktop app, and the first thing everyone grunts when you go to sell it to them is like, oh, really? I got to spend more time at my desk. And it's like, no. Like, once it's all organized on your desktop, then you just shoot it out to your mobile. And then when you get back from the field, you just download your data. You don't have to sit in front of a computer all day keying that information in. And that was a big selling point. So that was where you could really get foresters on board, and foresters that typically would rather be in the field, doing their thing than sitting in front of a keyboard clunking away. So that was, for us, we learned pretty early, people don't want to be in front of a computer. They want to be in the field. So the solution had to have some sort of a benefit that way, where you're getting people into the field and not bogging them down. And one of the things with silviculture, which is PlantWizard is focused on, I haven't even gone into that, but PlantWizard is just an application to organize tree planting projects. So I say just, there's a lot to it, but tree planting projects have all kinds of components. One of the sort of key components is the fact that you have to plan it in advance. So you we're typically not planting seeds, we're planting trees. So because of that, the tree has to be grown in advance, and you want to plant the forest shortly after you harvest the forest. So you essentially have to start growing trees before you harvest the forest in order to be ready to plant them with some 1 or 2 year old seedlings before, or sorry, right after the harvesting takes place. So ideally, you're planting things before the trees are cut down. You're already growing new trees for that site in a nursery. That's kind of where the trickiness comes. Because, you know, if you just waited for the trees to get cut down and then you went out and you made some perfect plan, you could be a little bit more accurate in terms of exactly what you needed to do on that site and then order exactly the right number of trees. But then you got to wait 2 years, not ideal. So, you know, the process normally in our industry is we're planting those seedlings, you know, a year or two in advance, and then they're ready to go when the sites are harvested. So that coordination, if I grow my seedlings for 100 different sites, by the time the seedlings are ready 2 years down the road, those sites have changed. So people changed their mind on the harvesting side. They went after different species, or, you know, roads didn't get built, or some permit didn't come in and you went somewhere else. So those 100 became a different 100. Maybe 70% of them are the same, but there's 30 new ones that are in there. That creates a mismatch between what you plan for. There's also the idea that when you're planning and you're walking around in a forest, you don't really get the perfect sense as to exactly how many trees you need and what types of trees you need, but you're guessing and you can do a pretty good job of that. But then when somebody swaps out 30% of the blocks for different blocks that you got to go plant, and you've got seedlings sitting there grown for those 30 blocks that didn't get harvested, now you need to do some juggling. And really, that's where Plant Wizard was born. Was there's a fair bit of work that happens in silviculture, especially in BC, where we've got lots of different species, lots of different sort of ecosystem types, where different trees grow better in different areas. We also have a lot of variability, not just north to south in the province, but also elevation wise. We've got, you know, areas that we harvest right down at sea level, and then areas that are, you know, 5,000-6,000 feet in elevation, sorry, meters, you know, 1500 meters. So that variability changes exactly what you're supposed to plant there. So if somebody took a block that was supposed to be harvested at sea level and they harvested one at the top of the mountain at 1500 meters, it's not going to be the same species, or even if it was, you need different seed for that area. So there's this mismatch that needs to, so foresters typically, or silviculture forester, one of their jobs is before planting season, so on you know, sometime early spring, late winter, you're juggling. You got, okay, well, here's my basket of seedlings. Here's my basket of areas I need to harvest. Now I need to do the best possible job, essentially like an optimization of putting the best seedlings I can on the best sites to end up with, hopefully overall, the best possible result in terms of the next crop. So, you know, 40, 50 years from now, maybe longer, when that next crop is ready, did I do a good job, or did I grow a bunch of, did I just plant whatever on that site? Well, that's could result in, you know, essentially really either the site doesn't, you know, sort of reach free to grow status or get to be reforested successfully. But even if it does, it may not grow as efficiently or as well, or you know, the species mix might not be optimal, those kinds of things. So we are farming. We're trying to produce the next crop as quickly and as best crop we can as quickly as possible. That juggling of seedlings is the very start of that. And that so doing a good job of that means a good job all the way down the line, an easier job for everyone else who's taking care of that forest until it's rotated into another harvest. So for our software, it was really about organizing that. It's a bit of a long-winded story, hopefully not too boring, but taking software just allowed us, people would do this management, this juggling on spreadsheets. I did it, every forester, and, you know, even when I travel out to Ontario, people go, hey, you ripped off my spreadsheet. I'm like, no, everyone made those spreadsheets. You have all these spreadsheets, and essentially it's just one of these niche products where its main competition is spreadsheets. And that's where, even back 20 years ago, that was the main competition. Everybody had their own spreadsheets. spreadsheets just have very limited capability when it came to, sure, they're really nice to look at a matrix of data. It's a very efficient way of looking at, you know, here's all the seedlings I've got, here's all the sites I've got, and, you know, sort of putting your numbers in there. It's a nice picture. You can print it off on a plotter and put it on the wall or something like that in a large format printer. It looks great. It is a nice way of viewing sort of the big plan. And these are big planting projects. These are, you know, not typically sort of your woodlot size. These are you know, hundreds of openings, hundreds of planters, millions of trees, and trying to make it all fit as best as possible in amongst the chaos. So there's a lot to it. I can talk for a long time about the intricacies, but just the bottom line is that there's a lot to it, and spreadsheets had limitations, as they typically do with, as you get into more complex project management. Our product took care of some of those things for you automatically. And then you add in the fact that when we started with Palm Pilots, but now of course it's more modern devices, but when you've got a mobile component where you can actually manage and record what happens in the field on a device, and you don't have to key that in. Because when I was doing this job in the field, you had to write everything down on paper that happened. Collect as much information as you can during the project. And then at the end of the project, there was like a month of sitting in front of a computer, keying it in and recording it. And even prior to computers, it was still, you had to put it onto a nice format, put it into a file folder, have it, your historical record keeping, being manual or digital, still required a lot of effort in the office to sort of like properly get those records recorded and organized. So
I'm sensing this stuff gave you some inspiration maybe to go a different direction with some of the other products, thinking of Plant Wizard as the first one. Maybe, you know, and I'll come back to Plants Wizard maybe to connect all the dots, but what would be the next one? Was it Forest Ops or was it Snap?
No, it was Snap.
It was Snap, really? Okay. Good thing I didn't bet you on the order of them, because I would have lost big time. So,
You know what? We'd have to chop that pot, because it was the next, but it also was the last product. So I'll explain. The next product was something called Survey Wizard. Just for continuity, we named it Survey Wizard, and we built a product that would allow foresters to collect more information. But instead of tree planting projects, it was silviculture surveys. So it was going out. Not timber cruising. We did do a Cruise Wizard app at one point. We don't do that anymore. But the silviculture survey is really just going out. How is the stand doing? You're going out 2 years after planting. You're going out, you know, maybe a year after planting, 2 years, and then 5 and 10, and just sort of getting to that point where you can sign off on the site as being, hey, we're free to grow. It's, everything's going along outside of a some sort of catastrophe. We're on our way to the next harvest. So the silviculture surveys is a big part of silviculture work, going out and monitoring these very new forest stands. So that required data collection and data compilation. It had two sort of steps, you know, similar to a timber cruise, but I would say even a little bit more intense, use of statistics to collect information and then roll that up and determine, okay, where are we at as a site? And because a silviculture survey wasn't just, you know, a timber cruise, you're not really doing much with a site other than harvest or no harvest. But in a silviculture survey, that it may result in, we need to go and do some more planting here because we had some you know, failed planting areas, or maybe we need to do some brushing, maybe we need to deal with some pest control, maybe. So it's really that monitoring of the health of the stand that you're going out and you're recording. So it gets kind of a little bit touchy-feely, or I don't know what the right word is saying it, but the forestry aspect really comes, the sort of silviculture forester part really comes into play, where you're looking at the stand, you're standing in the stand, and you're going, well, what should we do here? Is this good? Should we just leave it for a few more years? Should we do something? Do we need to treat this stand with something? So that's all part of it on top of the data collection. So you're also collecting the supporting data for those decisions at the same time. What doing that on a Palm Pilot originally allowed users to do was collect the data in the field and analyze the data in the field, and then record those sort of, you know, activities or whatever that they're planning for the site, whatever actions need to be taken, they can go and record that. And they have the supporting data that actually you can compile it in the field as well, do all the statistics while you're standing there. And, you know, do I need to collect more information? Or am I good? Have I got enough? Does this information support the decision that I think, you know, something should be done here? And then you can move on. If you've got it, basically it's your pocket computer. It tells you, it sort of summarizes everything. And this typically was done in the office by hand, manually. Again, you're really just cutting out that big office compilation and data sort of organizing part in the office. And this, I think it had two benefits. One is that reduction of office work again. And the other benefit was really just allowing you to have that decision support data in the field with you. So if you can see those statistics and so on while you're standing in the trees, it makes you feel a little bit more confident about the prescription that you would have for that site. So I think this should be done. You can look at your data while you're standing there. Yes, this supports that plan. So it offers a little bit of, you know, it's just that decision support tools, which we're all involved in the forestry software space, but it brings it right to the field while you're standing there. Really great. So that was kind of a step. We called it Survey Wizard. So that product doesn't exist anymore, but we replaced it with Snap. So what I said before, where you're kind of right and kind of wrong, Snap replaced Survey Wizard as more of an all-round data collection tool. So we still do all of our civil culture survey collection with that tool, but we also do your EMS and different types of data that's collected in the field. There's, you know, it might be payroll, it might be whatever that for a crew, it might be all sorts of field data collection. So we found is once our users had this tool, there was other things they wanted to record outside of civil culture surveys in the field and have that data, you know, sort of transcribed automatically back to the office database. So that's where Snap was kind of born, as more of an all-round data collection system for the field. The thing that makes it special over, say, other data collection systems would only be the aspect that it has really sort of complex compilation abilities in it. So if we design a specific form for data collection for it, which we do, it can have very intense data sort of compilation statistics, that kind of thing with it. Whereas if you just went and got some sort of form builder off the internet somewhere, installed it on your phone, it would work, it would collect data, but you wouldn't be able to perform those same high level statistics and that kind of thing on that data. Not easily, not in a product that we're aware of. So that's kind of our specialty with that product.
Right. So a little bit more than just pure data collection, but adding the statistics in. So, yeah. so thank you. We're already 40 minutes in. So I feel like we're no need to apologize. I always tell people that share their story, right? And for those listening, you know, you're getting educated as well. But I'm kind of feeling like this is all culminating into forest ops, you know, through all these stories. I'm sensing you've heard all this feedback from the community, all these needs, yeah, wants, desires, and then somehow if I'm connecting the dots, and suddenly it's like, hey, it's like, is this forest ops thing we got to build? So tell me about that, maybe the three key features of that, and we'll see if we'll tie the other ones back into that story.
Sure. So forest ops really wasn't born from, hey, you've got these other products and now we'll build a bigger, better version or something connected to it. It was a separate product, and really a separate project that we had a company come to us and say, we need a product to do a specific task. And it was the Forest Ops product was born out of, it was Canfor that came to us. So they came to us and said, hey, we've hired these management consultants to come in. I don't remember the name of them, but their management consultants come in. They built us some really extreme spreadsheets to do some management around harvest planning. And it was really around, we wanted to have a better, you know, their vision, which was, you know, great, was a better overall view and ability to forecast what's going to happen in the next 12 to 24 months in their forest harvesting schedule. So what does it look like? What options do we have? Where are we going to get our timber? What do the profiles look like? What does the finances look like attached to that? It wasn't quite that elaborate. It was more of really a schedule around, for them, it was in the initial piece that we got involved in, was a spreadsheet that was really just, here's the, so for the main purpose behind it was more, and these are sort of the MBA types that came in as management consultants to sort of like say, hey, you should have a process to what you're doing. And they do, there is a, you know, there's natural processes in forestry management, but they wanted us something that would allow the staff to kind of keep track of where are we at in the pipeline. So as you imagine with a harvesting cut block, you plan it quite a ways out. So you're a few years out from harvesting it, and you start to make plans. We need to go and design a road. We need to build a road. We need to figure out where the boundaries are going to be. We need to apply for permits. We need to get those permits in. And we also need to do all of our environmental checklists to make sure that you're not, creating any kind of environmental problems associated with the harvesting. So there's quite a checklist, essentially like a pipeline or a roadmap to go from, hey, concept, we should go harvest on this hillside to, let's go to having a permit in hand and get out there with your crew and log it. So that pipeline was what they were addressing. That process was what they were addressing. They were really getting down to, okay, well, this needs to happen before this happens, and then this happens, and so on. And you can't say you're going to harvest it 3 months from now if you don't have permit into the government, because we know it takes more than 3 months for them to approve a permit. So, you have to move that one back. If you don't have a permit for it, you're going to have to, push it out in the schedule and keep things moving in a way that, so it was really just, it was like a workflow, and almost a workflow check on that plan. So if you've got things in the pipeline, but you haven't done A, B, or C yet, well, then you're going to have to push it back and get those things done. And so that was really the tool that they had built in a spreadsheet. It was a very fancy kind of looking spreadsheet, but and I don't know if I'm sharing too much or whatever.
No, it's okay. So I'm just wondering how would we go about categorizing that, Rod? Like, is it a forest management system? Is it a decision support tool? Is it more of a planning system? Or
it's all of the above, I think. I mean, at one point we kind of referred to it as a tactical planning system. But if we look at it, we used to use the term here. I don't know how much it's thrown around anymore, but we used to, when we were doing long-term plans in sort of forestry in this part of the world anyway, in BC, we used a term called total chance planning, which was, let's have a plan for all options. So what, if markets change, if the weather changes, if whatever, we can still do our thing and get wood flowing and that kind of thing. And so in order to have that, you've got to have options on the table, but those options have to be real options. They can't be imaginary. So in order for that option to, if we can't go there in 3 months, we'll go here in 3 months. Well, then that you have to get those jobs done in ahead. So it really falls into it. It sort of falls into that decision support part, where right away when we started, so we built a system to do this for Canfor. It wasn't a custom system. The only way we would agree to build it is something that we could build and just sell to everybody. They didn't pay for the development. We did, but. So it was just, hey, we'll build it on our dime and we'll go sell it to other people, but we'll first build the first version is just for you, like for your, to meet your needs. So that's how we went about constructing Forest Ops. As we went to sell it, it expanded into sort of the financial side of things. So start off with that sort of activity planning, sort of coordinating thing that was really important in order to sort of like know that those are options, that your total chance plan was a real thing, and this is just so that you can feel comfortable as a shareholder or whatever that things are going to move forward no matter what. If the weather changes, if the market changes, whatever, we got plans, we know what we're doing, as opposed to if you go back 20, 30, 40 years in the industry, something happens and the brakes get put on and, well, we didn't anticipate that. We didn't get that permit. So we just sent our loggers home. Well, that's not going to work. Or the mill's going to shut down now and all that kind of. So, you know, you just imagine this big supply chain that gets disrupted by things. You have to have plans in place for all these different things. And those plans just take a little bit more. For those plans to be real, people want to see, okay, well, where, how do we know this is all an option rather than just sort of relying on, you know, some harvesting supervisor, no problem, we'll go get those logs no matter what. Well, okay, how, you know, so it really just sort of laying it down data wise and proving it out. So that became valuable because as markets are volatile, as we know in forestry, as markets turn downwards, decision support, it's like, well, where should, if we have to curtail operations, where should we be curtailing operations? What makes sense for us as a company? Which harvest areas should we not go to, and which ones should we go to if market conditions financially change? Market conditions can also change in terms of the types of wood that people are after, but also like what is the value of that wood, and if things change, do we need to curtail? If we do, you know, like one of the most, you know, it's kind of an awful decision, but it's reality is, will we lose less money if we log that area or if we send everyone home? So you know, it's not a zero cost operation when you just send everybody home. It's still, you still have bills to pay. So it's really just the best financial decision. So it really became decision support for high level within organizations to know, be able to forecast with a high level of accuracy what was going to happen next year and the year after. And that's really where the selling feature came with Forest Ops, became popular in terms of us being able to sort of get the product going with a lot of the large organizations in our province and now outside of BC, where some large customers in the United States, New Zealand, Australia, that rely on it for that forecasting ability. So it's really just a detailed forecasting tool that has a easier user interface than say, I mean, you could put all the data into a spreadsheet, or, you know, a lot of the data that's used is actually would come from typical large in-house database systems that are out there. We bring the data in and then allow an interface for the users to sort of do some more detailed planning on top of that data. So, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. So I'm sensing in this conversation, the stories you're sharing, a lot of the work for JRP Solutions was focused around, you know, data, the mobility component, and early, mind you, by the sounds of some mm-hmm. things, you know, when you talk about bringing data back on the Palm Pilot, I still remember when you plugged in that cable and watching that little progress bar. It was like therapeutic, right? Like, oh, 0 of 200, here we go. And it hits 200. It's complete. Yes. Like, just like, oh, eureka moment there. But I mostly clearly sensing, you know, like, you know the space intimately well, you've lived those challenges that foresters have been dealing with, and you were focused on how to make those workflows easier, more streamlined, give foresters more tools. And so of course our audience, you know, encourage you to visit JRP Solutions, their website, to learn more about the products. But I'm just going to maybe pivot the conversation a little bit differently, given that you have such a breadth of experience in this space. And the question I have for you is what's changed from when you first started building things out to where we are today? Because truthfully, some of the stories as you share, we're sharing them, I was kind of chuckling going like, I'm pretty sure I just had a conversation with somebody last week about exactly the same thing. So from your seat and your journey, it's like, what are maybe some of those major shifts in technology beyond the usual mobile and the form factors and the Apples and the Androids? But are there a couple, maybe give me the top three Rod Poirier trends or shifts that have happened the last, let's say, 2 to 3 decades that really has moved the yardstick forward in terms of digital technologies for foresters?
That's probably a long answer for me.
That's why I said three. That's why I said three.
Yeah, I know. And I actually don't think there's that. It's not the number of items in my mind. It's more of the qualifying them. So, I mean, one of the things that's really pushed things forward is regulation. So, and I don't, you know, I'm not a big fan of government interference in our lives, but when it comes to forest management, I've lived through a lot of eras, since the late 80s, and a lot of it has been government regulation. So there's government regulation kind of in BC in our area. It got replaced for the most part in terms of the motivation. I'll just back this up and say this is motivation behind the progress in systems and organizing your data. So one key area is sort of regulation that initially sort of came from government, but then almost become self-regulating in certification. So as the forest companies become required, you know, Home Depot says, look, you're going to need to be certified if I'm going to buy your 2x4s from you. Do you go through a certification process where you kind of define your own regulations almost, where you basically set forth, this is how we do business, and then proof that through audits to satisfy, you know, some sort of level of certification as to your business is doing proper forest management to some degree, where, you know, you're looking out for different stakeholders, that kind of thing. And so that pushes the requirements in terms of companies to be organized. The other part of it is finances, is that in the early parts of my career in the late 80s, early 90s, and so on, the market was super volatile, the industry was super volatile. I'd say some of that is better now, but you go through these market swings where wood is worthless and then wood is gold, you know, and as we go through those, it becomes difficult for shareholders to be confident when they buy a share in a big forest management, you know, say publicly held company. They go to the stock market, they go buy a share. It's hard for them to have confidence that looking forward, there's actually something there where the market isn't going to fall off a cliff and I'm going to lose, my shares are going to drop and I'm going to lose, my investment. So as the sort of the financial world investing in these forest companies, there's a level of confidence that's needed. So, you know, one of the things that I've seen in throughout my career is that an increase in kind of the sort of financial control side of you know, big large organizations. So that a larger focus over the last 40 years in terms of we're going to manage our costs. We're going to have more accountants in place to keep track of what we're spending, where we're spending it on. And do a better job of forecasting where we're going to be. And so that's all part of, you know, it's kind of relating that back to the sort of forest ops product, but that has pushed technology. You know, I think even a lot of the technologies you're involved in, that kind of stuff, it really, a lot of the benefit comes in being able to optimize to better predict what you're after, what you're going to get in those operations going forward. So where are we going to be sitting financially is the big, you know, the bottom line for a lot of these, especially publicly held organizations that have to answer to shareholders. Where are we going to be? Why is it a good thing to buy shares in this company? And can we manage those ups and downs of our sort of like global cyclical market? And so that has pushed, technology has to become part of that. You have to do a better job of, the only way you can do a better job of analyzing, optimizing, and forecasting is really to have a better grip on data, and that data can't be in a file cabinet. So that's, I think, if, you know, I don't know if that's really a top three kind of a thing, but that would be my general synopsis as to why we've seen the technology push so fast. So
yeah, very interesting. Very interesting viewpoint. And I know when we started this podcast, you had made the statement, you know, pulling foresters or the forest industry along for the ride. Where do you think we are today? Do you think we're still pulling the forest industry along, or do you think maybe there's more, you know, use that term push, maybe a little bit of push from them? Well, what's your view on the landscape today?
No, we still see both. I mean, I think, you know, you and I probably see the same kinds of things as we talk to foresters here and there. You know, and I think it kind of in some ways hasn't really changed, where, you know, in the 80s, before I even finished high school, I remember talking to one of the engineers at McMillan Bodell that my father worked for. So one of his friends who was an engineer for the company is over at our house in the kitchen, and I'm like 16 or 17, and he's telling me all about this really expensive project that they've endeavored to track all of the specs of the logging trucks as they operate every day. So they know the tire pressure, the oil pressure, the, you know, how much fuel it's burning and all that stuff. This is 40 years ago. And So there was efforts, you know, way back when that were very much like a lot of that hasn't even been achieved today. So, but there was foresters, there was people in the industry thinking and trying really advanced technologies or trying to apply advanced technologies. And, you know, that was all through radio towers and transmitting data and, you know, like pretty cool stuff. They were trying, they were thinking of it. They were realizing there was, they were seeing the value if they could pull it off. A lot of those things just, you know, if the cost benefit isn't there, eventually those projects don't make it to fruition, or, you know, for whatever the reason might be. But that would be, but at that same time, when I entered the industry in the late 80s, and I'm a summer student, and I'm working with some of these same engineers at McMillan Waddell as a summer student, some of them were just absolutely staunch anti-technology. Back then, there was like one computer in the office that cost $80,000. Like there was no tech in the late 80s, really, that and most of the engineers and foresters were, you know, not a chance. They're not going anywhere near it. And we still kind of see that mix, maybe a little bit different today, but I still see, you know, when you're talking to people, really ambitious ideas about, you know, using data and satellites and whatever to have more real-time information. And so, you know, you look at the, you know, like the podcast you just did with Marco at Mosaic, and you know, those kinds of projects, the same kind of thing they just sort of completed in Australia with one of our customers. Really cool stuff. You know, that's kind of stuff that, you know, they were talking about in the 80s, but now we're able to do it with, we've got better infrastructure, technology infrastructures. You're able to actually get some of those projects done and realize some of that really exciting kind of value associated with it. So, but then you still have the foresters that, so in terms of foresters, I think you still have that mix of people that would just rather be in the field. Let's give me a piece of paper and a pencil, send me to the bush, and I'm happy. And I understand, I used to do that. And it is in some days, it's very much, you know, better for the brain than sitting in front of the computer like we do all day. So, so I totally get that. And then there's some foresters really pushing the envelope in terms of like, hey, let's wire together all these cool new technologies. And, you know, the buzz these days, of course, is AI, and, you know, who knows where that's going to go, self-driving.
That was going to be my
decision making and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, and that was going to be my last question. But before I push that question forward, it's interesting you frame it as the foresters that just want to be out in the bush, right, with their you know, pencil, paper, who cares, versus the ones that are always kind of pushing the limit, you know, the sky is endless. And at times I wondered, could we just not get some foresters in the middle of these two extremes to then deliver these digital transformation projects and realize some success? But you nailed it on the head. With the time we have left, the last question I'm going to throw your way, Rod, is around AI. A lot of hype there. You know, we'll chat with people and they're all excited about AI, and yet they're still living in the filing cabinet, I think was the, I like that term, world. And it's like, you're never going to get to the AI part if that is where you're coming from. Like, you have so many steps ahead of you that you need to put in place. But maybe in a you know, in a minute or two, maybe summarize to me what your worldview is for AI in forestry. Is it still buzzword, I guess, for foresters, or is it something that we should really pay attention to? And if so, is there a good example where you can think of on the spot to highlight that point?
Right. Well, so with AI in general, I'm definitely guilty of going down some YouTube rabbit holes and watching some of these amazing demos and so on, whether it be like humanoid robots or actual AI, like, you know, things like Sora and stuff like that, that can, you just sort of like, it's puzzling that these machines can create such stuff from a simple prompt or what have you. So it definitely seems like a magic trick to me at this point. And, you know, when I look at it, it's absolutely amazing. And I could see I think that's the reason it's a buzz sort of word or term, but I don't think there's nothing there. But at the same time, I don't fear that it's going to take over all our jobs tomorrow. I think that's, I think it's going to change. If anything, what it should do is just really give us, you know, we talk about decision support. Well, it's almost the ultimate decision support. It's basically telling you the answer. In a lot of cases, like whether you're, you know, maybe you're writing a document or whatever, and it's, but maybe you don't like it. And, you know, I'll use, you know, the, you know, some of the chat AIs in order to develop some of the writing that I'll do. It shortens it from, you know, I often take time if I'm writing an important email, I'll take an hour to write it. But now I can cut that down to, you know, 10 minutes. I'll never really use exactly what AI gives me, but I do find it cleans up my communication sometimes, clarifies it, and you can ask it, take a longer one and say, make this shorter or whatever. So I do find it's useful in a day-to-day applications. It's a long ways, like in terms of forestry. Yeah, I agree with you. Like you, if you, I think we're a little ways from it being able to provide good decision support in the forest industry, but we may not be as far away as we think we are. Like I, you know, I'm always amazed, like when, you know, OpenAI comes out with 4.0 a few weeks ago, it's like, wow, just when you think it's kind of getting a little, you know, stale or what have you, it's like they blow your mind again with new and better capabilities. So I think the answer is we don't really know how fast it's going to creep up on us. I think it's a little bit like all these technologies we've been involved in for decades now, where it's not going away. It's going to become more prevalent. There's no doubt about that in my mind. And I think, but it's again, forest industry is probably maybe on purpose, maybe not. It will probably be one of the last places that it really gets applied in, but yeah, maybe not. It's really hard to know. But I am impressed by AI so far. But I'm not expecting it to do anything really transformational to society or to the forest industry quite yet. I think we're a few years away. So.
Yeah, and I think we can both agree that whoever is digital or has many digital data points will probably benefit more quickly from the AI than those
Absolutely.
that are
Yeah,
not.
that's clear that the better the data that you've got, the more money you spend, whether it's LiDAR or whatever, understanding the forest base you have, the more potential there is for utilizing AI. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as we look to wind down, I guess thinking of JRP Solutions, you know, in this conversation, like obviously very knowledgeable in this space, lots of experiences. I feel like we can chat for hours, and we probably could. We just need a couple soda pops beside us, a little wobblies there. But as we look to wind down, what's the future for JRP Solutions? Like, what a fascinating, amazing story. Congratulations as well, you know, as the entrepreneurial life can be a long slog, lonely at times. But hey, at 20 years, you know, that's something to celebrate. Not that many people are able to create these types of businesses that are long lasting. So, and sincerely, a sincere comment, like, congratulations to you and Julie about that. So, when we look to wind down, as we look forward to JRP, what's the future hold?
Well, first, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. The future, you know, I think about that constantly, and that's another bit of a long-winded answer. But I mean, I think for us, it's really just plodding forward and continuing to improve the solutions that we have. So we've been pretty dedicated. So I mentioned that we took on partners. We also bought those partners out about 10 years ago. And so we own the business. We're the only owners of the business these days. And with that, we've had you know, there was a strict focus on the three products that we had at the time, still have, just sort of continuing to improve those products and improve their abilities. We still see some runway in terms of being able to move those products forward. So that's for us, right? What we're seeing going forward is just continuous improvement. That's been the theme here. It's, you know, as you know, in the same space, it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back sometimes, but you're just, you know, if you just constantly sort of focus on improving those offerings, and that's us. So in terms of, you know, where we are in 5 years, hopefully just three good products and three better products than we have even now. So yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. So for those who want to follow up, because believe it or not, with this podcast, apparently it is a global reach. Most people are surprised by how many folks listen to this. But for those who want to follow up with you and learn more about Plant Wizard, Snap and Force Ops and other things that JRP Solutions can offer, what's the best way for folks to get a hold of you?
Old-fashioned email is probably the best, info@jrpltd.com, and that'll get to us. And we're a small outfit, easy to find any of us that work here. So that's probably the best way to reach out. I mean, you can also get to us through our website, but rather than filling out a form, you can just go send an email to info@jrpltd.com.
Perfect. Awesome. Well, there you go, folks. If you want to learn more about JRP Solutions and the cool products and great products, truthfully, beyond good that Rod and co have built, feel free to go to the website or send an email. Okay, Rod. Well, it was great from bumping into each other in Kofi, and we had actually never met before. So it's kind of cool to have a brief chat. And I've just loved this conversation with you, to hear the story, the passion, truthfully, as well as you're sharing these stories. As I said, we can have super fun chatting for hours, and I'm sure we'll do another follow-up pod there. But thanks very much for joining with us. And again, for our listeners, our audience, definitely encourage you to check out JRP Solutions and what they have online. So thanks very much, Rod.
All right. Thank you, Kevin. Take care.
Take care.